Speaking on this program is Chris Perry.
Well, it is wonderful to be here with you this evening. I know several of you out in the pews this evening, and it's good to get to see you again. There's some that I don't know as well, and I hope that I can get to know you a little bit better. I appreciate you folks for having me out. The elders for seeing fit to have me come out here this evening. You can go ahead and open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 16. And as you can see up on the screen, my lesson will come in particular from verse 26. That was my assigned topic. Kevin Key gave me this presenter. And as he handed it to me, I said, oh, you know, I'm sure the buttons work like they normally do, right? Forward is forward and backwards is backwards. Oh, yeah. Do left to go back, or left to go forward and right to go back. I said, well, that's opposite of how I would think it would be. And he said, well, then I don't know how it goes. So let's just try this out. Okay, So we're right. So forward is forward and back is back. So all is right with the world. But I wanted to make sure of that before we moved any farther along. So Matthew 16, 26. I got a later start in my Christian life than maybe many of you did in this room this evening. I was a sophomore or junior in college when I obeyed the gospel. And for some reason, I'm not even sure that I intended it to be this way. The first passage of Scripture that I ever committed to memory was Matthew 16, 26. And I think it just happened by accident. I don't know that it was on purpose. I don't think that I was, you know, using the verse for any particular reason. This verse, at a very early stage in my Christian development, was one of the first verses that stuck with me. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for a soul? And so Kevin called me, and I believe at that time he still had several topics available, and I said, ooh, I want that one. And then I looked back in my notes. I've been preaching long enough. I don't know if Kevin does this, that one of the first things I do is say, okay, what have I preached on before? And let's kind of peruse some of the things I've done in the past. And I had never preached on this verse. And I've used it in sermons. I've referenced it. I've taught through Matthew. I've done all that and never preached on it. And so that's what we're going to do tonight. And we're going to do a few things as we go through tonight. Now, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at the context, because to me, understanding Matthew 16, 26 is only really possible if you understand the context that it's placed in. Because after all, this is a discourse by Jesus. It's not as if Jesus just stood up, said what's in Matthew 16, 26, and then sat down. And so to understand Matthew 16, 26, we need to understand the context. And so we'll do that as we have the chance this evening. And then we'll notice the perspective. When Jesus spoke the words in Matthew 16, 26, what was His perspective? And that's of particular importance with this passage, and we'll notice that. And then we'll notice the text, that is, the specifics of Matthew 16, 26, and then try to extend some application to us as we have the opportunity. So what about the context? I'm going to break this down into a few slides. What we have, and we're going to begin in verse 13 of Matthew 16 with the immediate context. Now, you're likely familiar with the first part of this context. Verses 13 through 20 is Peter's confession. You remember that Jesus came to the disciples and said, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And they began to give the various people that they were equating Jesus with. Verse 14, some say thou art John the Baptist, Elias, Jeremiah, one of the prophets. But he said, "Who do you say that I am?" And then, of course, this is a whole different discussion, but who answers but Peter? Now, Peter is the one who's going to do the answering, because his personality lends itself to being that outspoken, ooh, me kind of person. And so Peter says, "Well, thou art the Christ, Son of the living God." And what a great confession that is. And Jesus goes on in the course of this passage, verses 13 through 20, to commend Peter. Verse 17, "Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona. Flesh and blood hath not revealed unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. I say also unto thee, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I'll give thee the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever you bound on earth shall be bound in heaven, and loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And so Jesus commends Peter for that good confession and talks to him, and by extension, all of the apostles, about the authority that they'll soon be given and all of those things. Well, immediately after that, I want you to look with me at verse 21, because to me here is where the context that leads up to verse 26 really begins. From that time forth, it says in verse 21, Jesus began to show unto his disciples how that he must go into Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. Now it says from this time. The indication is likely that Jesus either had not mentioned it up to this point, or at the very least, he had not mentioned it in such detail. The future that awaited Jesus in Jerusalem, tried, convicted, crucified, and placed in a tomb. Now, it would be natural, and we have hindsight, so we are quick to judge the responses of the apostles sometimes, but it would be natural for us to have at least some semblance of the reaction that Peter had. But you look at verse 22, then Peter took him. The idea of that original language there indicates that Peter took him aside, almost laid hands on him and drug him away from everybody else and said, "Hey, wait a minute, Jesus." And notice what he says here in verse 22, and he began to rebuke him. Now, can you imagine after everything that Peter's witnessed of Jesus, for him to have the audacity to yank Jesus aside and to rebuke him and say, "Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee." So Peter said, "You will not go to the cross." Now what was behind that? Well, Peter, like all of the disciples, it seems, and many of the people who followed and claimed to follow Jesus, Peter had the idea that Jesus was coming to establish a kingdom, an earthly kingdom. And he would say on a number of occasions, you know, "We've forsaken all, what shall we have, therefore?" They still believed that there was something physical in it for them. And so when Jesus said, "Look, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, but I'm not going to go and reign. I'm going to go and be crucified." Peter says, "Wait a minute. I've been following you with at least some shred of hope that I would receive something for this deal, and you're telling me that the end of this road is crucifixion? There's no way that for my Messiah, the one that I've been waiting on, there's no way that that's going to happen because I have sacrificed too much. I've put too much into this." And Peter said that on other occasions. Verse 23, Jesus rebukes him. And his answer, verse 23, but he turned. It seems as if it says they're looking face to face, and then Jesus whips around and said unto Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Notice how strong the rebuke is by Jesus in verse 23. "Thou art an offense, you're a stumbling block, you are in my way. For thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." So Jesus rebuked Peter for that attitude. There was something in that attitude that especially displeased Jesus. And what was it? Well, that's where the direct context of Matthew 16:26 comes into play. Look at the very next word. Verse 24, the very next word is "then." After Jesus has said, "I'm going to have to go to be crucified," after Peter has said, "It will not happen to you," after he rebuked him, after Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan, you're an offense to me," after that, "then." Jesus said this in verse 24, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross," Luke adds, "daily, and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it." You see, the context continues. The first thing he talks about is individual personal responsibility. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. He says, "Look, Peter, you are responsible for your soul, and you have the future of your soul in your hands." Number two, Jesus taught self-denial. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself. You see, I believe Jesus' statement, "let him deny himself," and Peter's statement of, "Oh, far be it from thee, Lord, this will never happen to thee because I've got something waiting on me in this earthly kingdom." I think those two ideas are connected. Peter still has in his mind that he's going to get something physical for his sacrifice and his service to God. And Jesus says, "Peter, you've got it all wrong. It's about self-denial. It's also about sacrifice. Let him deny himself and take up his cross." Peter, there's something you're going to have to give up. There's something you're going to have to give away. There's something that you're going to have to deny yourself regularly if you are to follow me. And then he says, follow me. Devotion. So in the context then, Jesus has rebuked Peter for his attitude, and then he has turned around and gotten right to the heart of the problem. The problem is selfishness. The problem is worldliness. The problem is materialism. That's the problem that seems to be plaguing Peter and the rest of the disciples who will follow him. You see, and then he says this. It's interesting, these two words. In verse 24, the word is then. And then in verse 25, he says, for. You see, that's a logical conclusion of what he's just said. He said, look, you're going to have to deny yourself because whoever will save his life shall lose it. And whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For, verse 26, what is a man profited? If he shall gain the whole world, lose his own soul, or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his work. Verily I say unto you, there shall be some standing here who shall not taste of death till they see the kingdom coming with power. So we see those two words, then and for, how the context moves to what we've been studying tonight. What we see here in the context then is a question about profit. Now Jesus is going to ask a rhetorical question, and we'll notice that in the text itself here in just a moment. But that rhetorical question is about profit. Peter, what are you hoping to get out of your following of me? And then he gives a statement about reward. Notice he says in verse 27, the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then shall he reward every man according to his work. And then he gives a statement about judgment. See the King, the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Of course, that's the opening of the doors of the church. And with it come the preaching of the gospel. And with the preaching of the gospel comes judgment. And ultimately, Jesus will return again in final judgment. So you see, the context all goes together. But as I was studying this text for this sermon that will come tonight, it was amazing to me how it all sort of flows. So Peter gave a confession. And if we stop there, you think, oh, Peter's doing great. And then Jesus gives that statement about having to die, and Peter isn't willing to give up his hope of an earthly kingdom. And because he's not willing to give up his hope of an earthly kingdom, it shows in Peter a lack of self-denial, a bit of self-centeredness and materialism. And because of his lack of self-denial, because of his self-centeredness and materialism, he is in danger of judgment. Now, you and I know how Peter's situation turns out, don't we? It's hard for him to give up that materialism, that worldliness, that sense of what he expects to happen versus what is actually happening. And I believe that's what causes Peter there to deny Jesus on not one, not two, but three occasions, just as Jesus said he would do. And for Jesus then to turn and look on Peter, and for Peter to go out and weep bitterly. You see, that's all behind the scenes of what's happening here in Matthew 16. Peter is in danger of judgment because the attitude of materialism that's inside of him right here in Matthew 16. What about the perspective? I'm not, and I don't claim to be, and you should not leave here believing me to be, a Greek scholar. I'm absolutely not. I suffered through Greek at the School of Preaching just like every other student did, and I use the resources that are readily available at my disposal to help me in my study of Greek now. But from what I glean from those who are experts in the Greek language, in Matthew 16:26, these two important words, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Those are, in the original language, in past tense. It's as if it should be translated thusly. What is a man profited if he may have gained the whole world, but in so doing have lost his own soul? So then what is the perspective from which these words are said? It's as if Jesus has fast-forwarded time, and he's now looking from judgment. It's as if Peter now is standing beside him at the judgment scene, and Jesus is saying, let's look back at your life and let's say, Let's say that you have gained the whole world in your life, but you've lost your soul. Peter, tell me what you're profited. See, that's the idea there. Once we get to judgment and we look back and Jesus judges the things that we've done, then we have to answer that question. What have we been profited? The unfortunate for many and the fortunate for others, truth about judgment is that at judgment, all action is frozen in the past. You know, the idea of purgatory is a pretty convenient one, right? So here's what they say can happen. Like I can die and I can have done things that were not pleasing to God and I could have not done things that were pleasing to God, but I can kind of hold up in this middle ground for a while and I can hope that somebody back in real life can do something to get me onto heaven, or that maybe I can pay my penance and eventually I can get to heaven. But the fact of the matter is, once we die, there's no second chances. And as it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment. When judgment comes, when my death comes, all actions are frozen in the past. What a frightening thought. See, and that's what Jesus is getting at. He says, look, when you look back on your life at judgment, you need to tell me what you've been profited. Passages allude to this over and over again throughout the New Testament. Matthew 7, 21 and following. Not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. And then he says, many will come to me in that day. What day is that? It's judgment. And they will say, have we not? Let's look back at our lives. Look at all the good things we've done. And Jesus will say, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. Your actions in the past are frozen. We can look at them. You know, these projector screens, I think, are a good way for us to, for me at least, to imagine the judgment scene. Imagine that this is the throne of judgment. And imagine that God is here behind the throne of judgment. And I am here being judged. And all of the scenes of my life, good and bad, are sliding before us on the screen. See, that's sort of how I imagine the judgment scene. And all of the bad things that are washed by the blood of Christ, well, they're deleted, right? They're not there. All of those good things that I've done, well, they're there. And if I'm righteous before God, all that remains is the positive. The bad's been washed. But you see, whatever I've done, it's already on the roll. Matthew 7, 21 alludes to that. In Luke 16, the account of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man realizes that he is in torments. And he begs Abraham for the opportunity, first of all, to somehow cross the chasm between him and Lazarus. But Abraham says, no, there's a great gulf fixed. You can't go back. Well, what about my brethren? Let's send somebody back and tell them. And he says, no, they wouldn't believe that one rose from the dead. You know what the tenor of Luke 16 reveals to us? Once we die, once we reach judgment, it is final. And everything's frozen in time. There's no chance to go back and rewind the clock. That's what we see in Luke chapter 16. That's what we see in Matthew 7, 21. In 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone will give account of the things that they've done according to that they have done, whether it be good or bad. It's already happened, and now I give account for it. As it rolls across the screen, I answer for every single thing not cleansed by the blood of Christ. Revelation 20 and verse 12, the judgment scene is described as having books open and another book, which is the book of life. And what is the book of life? It's page after page full of the actions of my life, already recorded there in black and white, never at judgment to be changed. Jesus says, Peter, I want you to look at your life as if you're standing at judgment, and I want you to look back and I want you to tell me whether or not you've been profited. See, that's the perspective. And to me, that's very powerful, and that reminds us just exactly how serious judgment is. So we've looked at the context, we've looked at the perspective. Now, let's take a look at the text. Verse 26, what is a man profited? If he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul, what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Let's paraphrase that. Is there profit in exchanging my soul for worldly things. Let's say I had the opportunity to exchange my soul for all of the world. Would it be a profitable exchange? That's the question. Now, it's a rhetorical question, which means the answer is implied, right? How do you like this dress? Your wife says. That's a rhetorical question, husbands. What's the answer? It's great. I love it. That's always the answer, right? Which dress do you like better? All of them. They're both great. It's a rhetorical question. The answer is implied. We know the answer. But I want you to withhold the answer and let's examine this question. The word profit and exchange, both of them really are financial terms. Think about it. There is an exchange rate. When I fly to India for a mission trip, one of the first things I have to do is I have to get my money, my American dollars, and I have to get them exchanged. I went to the Philippines several years ago to do that, and the fellow that I was with said, here at the airport, there are places that you go to exchange money, and there are places that you don't go. Because some of the places will extort exorbitant exchange fees from you. And so you will lose so much money in the exchange process that it won't be profitable, it won't be worth your time. So you have to be very careful how you exchange your money from one currency to another. So we know about exchange rates. That's a financial idea, to take one thing and exchange it or turn it into something else. The word profit literally means to increase. Is there any increase in doing this versus doing that? That's a financial term. So the idea is of advantage. For the word exchange, it's got two words. The first we recognize, the Greek word anti, means against or instead of. And the word allos, which is one word for different or change. So the idea is, if I change this for something different, have I made a profit? That's what you want to do, right? How many of you, if you owned a car dealership, would you make a practice of buying your cars for more than you sell them for? How long will your business work if that's the case? Say you own a restaurant and you have $3 in a hamburger and you sell it for $2.50. How long will your restaurant stay in business? Let's say that you build homes and it takes you $100,000 in materials and you sell it for $95,000. I'd love to buy a house from you, but your business won't last. The exchange is poor and the profit isn't there. Profit and exchange. Those are financial terms that you and I should readily understand. And so the idea again is, if you gain the whole world and you lose your own soul, is there a profit? We should understand and know what that answer is. The answer is no. Nothing is worth exchanging for my soul. You see, this is one of those questions that everybody on the street would agree with. Anybody who has any inkling that we have an eternal soul and that there is an eternal judgment, anybody who believes those two facts would acknowledge the truth of this answer, wouldn't they? No, there's nothing that I could take that would be worth exchanging my soul. That's what we say in general terms. But in actuality, there are a myriad of people who give their souls up for all sorts of worthless things. It happens every day. I don't know some of you good folks, but chances are it happens here with us in this room tonight. People who have looked at what the world has to offer and they've said, this is something that I want. And then they realize that in order to take it, they're going to have to compromise their spirituality. And they make the decision to do it. You know what they've done? They've sold their soul for something that's not near as valuable as their soul is. You know, there's people in the Old Testament and New Testament all throughout the course of time who have done just that. Think about Esau. Esau sold his birthright. I'd like you to turn to Genesis 25, if you don't mind, this evening. Just for a moment, I worried about time, and then I realized, hey, this is just a Sunday night. I've got all kinds of time, right? Time is just a number. I didn't get a lot of nodding there. I don't think y'all agree. In Genesis 25, but I want you to notice the words used. I don't know that this is a mistake. I don't believe it is. I don't think it was coincidence.
Verse 29, and Jacob sawed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. Give me what rightfully belongs to you as the firstborn son. Now I want you to notice what Esau's response is. And Esau said, behold, I am at the point to die. And what? What's that next word? And what profit shall his birthright, this birthright, do to me? Profit. What did he say? He said, this mess of pottage right here is more valuable to me than my birthright as the eldest son. Can you imagine that? Now, I've been pretty hungry. I may not look it, but I enjoy eating. And I married the right woman because she loves to cook. And she cooks some great meals. We've got someone staying with us, and she said tomorrow she's going to make homemade biscuits, gravy, bacon, eggs. We're going to have homemade jelly on those biscuits. Y'all want to come over? But I've never been so hungry that I was willing to give up everything that I own, everything that was in my financial future, in order to have that one meal. But Esau exhibited an attitude physically that I see people exhibit all the time spiritually. They're only worried about the here and the now. And as long as their lusts and their desires can be filled here and now, they don't take any consideration for what's out in the future. They don't do like Jesus did and fast forward to judgment and say, let me look back and see what my profit is. They don't do that. They make a snap decision in the here and the now without any regard for the consequences. That's what Esau did. And so he lost. And buddy, did he ever lose. Eventually he would lose not only his birthright, but the spiritual blessing as well. And Esau would be left behind in the course of history. Achan. God told Joshua, as long as you follow my directions, you'll be victorious in the land of Canaan. And every army you face, you'll be victorious, no matter how large their numbers and how small yours. I will fight for you, God would tell them. And so they go and they first of all march around the walls of Jericho. They do just as he directed, and the walls fall down flat and they take Jericho. And then Joshua chapter 7, there's Ai. And the results are the exact opposite in Ai, and the question is why? And so Joshua calls the congregation together and he says, there's sin in the camp. And so they go through the process that God directs, and eventually Achan is forced to step forward. You know what? Achan sold the entire victory of that army of Israel. You know what he sold it for? He sold it for 200 shekels of silver, 50 shekels of gold, and a Babylonian garment. Now, how much is that worth? That's a great question. I can't just go to JCPenney's and price a Babylonian garment, so I'm not really sure how much that's worth. You know, in my nosing around at various sources, maybe you're looking at 30 or 40 grand. Maybe you got a new car out of the deal. Was it worth staking the future of his nation on that paltry amount of money? No, it wasn't. He saw something and he took it without regard for the future consequences. What about Samson? Samson was a Nazarite. The indication is because he was not supposed to be around dead bodies. He had long hair. He was a Nazarite. And that Nazarite vow was important to him, so important to him that he realized, if I cut my hair, I lose my strength. Not because my hair equals my strength, but it's the vow. It's my dedication to God that makes me strong. He sold his strength. He lost his eyes. Eventually, he lost his life because he saw a woman and he wanted her. And he didn't care about her character. Didn't care about her background, didn't care about her intentions for him. He saw something and he took it, and it cost him everything. Do you see a pattern here? People living by their lusts, people fulfilling their desires without any concern for the future consequences. See, that's what Jesus was getting at in Matthew 16, 26. Can you think of one more who did that? After the rich young ruler that you see there, number four, a young man who came to Jesus and he had everything going for him. All these things I've kept from my youth up, when Jesus alludes to the Old Testament law. And Jesus, beholding him, loved him and said, "One thing you lack. Go and sell everything and give to the poor." Now, this is an interesting study to me, this study of the rich young ruler, as we call him, because Jesus didn't tell everybody to sell everything they had. Why did he tell this man to sell everything that he had? Because that was the one thing that that young man was unwilling to do. And Jesus said, if there's anything that comes between you and me, you got to get rid of it. And for you, it happens to be your money. So get rid of it. And the young man went away very sorrowful because he had great possessions, Matthew 19, 22. What is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What will a man give in exchange for a soul? Great possessions were more important to him than his soul. But what about the last one? Can you think of it? How about Judas? Judas Iscariot sold his Savior for 30 pieces of silver. Let's quantify in our minds how much 30 pieces of silver is. I didn't take the time to equate that to modern money, but here's what I can do for you. In Exodus 21, 32, if you have a servant, and that servant has been mauled by an animal, do you know how much your neighbor whose animal mauled your servant, you know how much he owes you? 30 pieces of silver. Jesus was betrayed for the price of a wounded slave. Judas realized what he had done. And he went back to those Jewish leaders to whom he had sold his soul. And he said, I don't want it. And he tried his best to sew up those loose ends, but they said, what does that matter to us? You see to it. And he threw the money down at their feet. I want you to notice, he threw the money down at their feet. You see, Judas really didn't care about the money when he really considered the consequences of what he had done. When he took that money to begin with, he wasn't thinking about consequences. He was doing whatever he thought he wanted to do in the moment. And when the consequences came raining down on him, the money didn't matter. He had counted the cost and he realized it wasn't worth it. And so he threw down the money. That's the money that eventually became the potter's field. You know, that's the text. And then Judas went out and he hanged himself. Why? Because he couldn't get his mind around what he had done. Now, when I preach Judas and Peter, I'm always astounded by the similarities between them. I don't believe there's really a great bit of difference between what Judas did and what Peter did. The difference is what Peter did afterwards. That's what makes the difference. See, Judas didn't count the cost. He didn't realize what he was doing until it was too late, and then he wasn't willing to handle the consequences. So here we have it. What about us? The point. Now that "the" is very impressive, but the word "point" is supposed to be after it. It didn't translate over, and that's fine. Do you know you're valuable? Do you know that you have a soul? Where'd that soul come from? You ever thought of that? In the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 2, it says that God formed man from the dust of the ground. You ever seen a kid play with Play-Doh? Smash the stuff together. What do they do when they make a mistake? You know, they smash it back and then they do it again. You know, when I see that, I'm reminded of what God is doing in a much more amazing and spectacular way. He takes from the ground and he forms man. And then what does he do? He breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. Where did my soul come from? It came from God Himself. There are some who speculate that maybe God gives up a little piece of Himself every time He gives us a soul. Which is why it's so excruciatingly painful to Him when one soul is lost for eternity. I don't know about that, but it's profound to think about where my soul comes from. My soul is more valuable than anything that the world could offer me. It's so valuable, in fact, that Jesus willingly gave Himself for it. For my soul, for your soul, let's remove everyone out of the room this evening. For you, Jesus died. Because your soul, if no one else existed, your soul would be valuable enough for Jesus to die for. You think about what He left, heaven. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. What did Jesus do? He thought it not robbery to be equal with God. What does that mean? That means He was like God. He was God. He dwelt with God. He is God. And He stepped down from heaven willingly and came to earth and suffered, became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. He did that willingly. But as I think about giving up the whole world for one soul, I think about Matthew 4 and the temptation of Jesus, remember, in the wilderness. What's the final temptation? Satan says, "Come here, Jesus." And he sets him on a high mountain. It's Matthew chapter 4, 8 through 10. And he shows him all the kingdoms of the world. And he says, "I will give you every kingdom that exists if you would just bow down and worship me." Now some say, well, you know, Satan couldn't really give that. He was bluffing. Well, he's the God of this world. This world belongs to him. The scriptures tell us the evil parts of it. Now God is in control of everything. I realize that. But I think Satan could have made good on his promise. But Jesus said, "You shall worship the Lord only. Him only shalt thou serve." See, Jesus could have had it all. But he chose instead to go to a cross. And he chose to do that for you. And he chose to do that for me. See, that's the point. You have value. Your soul is more valuable than the rest of the world. But it's only really as valuable as you make it. This evening, maybe you have exchanged your soul for something of no value. Maybe you have a job that forces you to compromise your spiritual life. And you've chosen to compromise to get ahead in your work. You know what you've done? You've exchanged your soul for something of no value. Maybe there's someone you love who has led you away from the truth. Someone who is among your friends or your family. And they've drawn you away from God. What you've done is you've chosen them. You've chosen them over the future of your soul. Maybe you're here this evening and there is some sin that you're involved in and you know it's sin and you know its consequences, but you choose it over your soul time and time and time again. Dear friends, it's time to fast forward to judgment. And it's time to look backwards and say, what am I profited if I continue down the road that I'm on? See, that is the point. But more importantly this evening, what are you willing to give up in order to save your soul? What would you give on the day of judgment to make it to heaven? How big a check would you write to miss eternal damnation? How many of your possessions would you gladly hand over to your most hated enemy on the day of judgment? Just to enter into the gates of heaven. How many of the activities that you love so dear that are taking you away from God, how many of those would you give up right now if you knew judgment was waiting around the next corner? What is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul, or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Maybe you are here tonight and there is something that you've given up in order to have salvation. Maybe you have obeyed the gospel. You've put aside worldly cares. You've believed in Christ. You've repented of your sins. You've confessed your faith. You've been immersed in water. But maybe that sin has returned. And maybe tonight as a Christian, you stand once again condemned because you have traded your soul for that which you know has no value. Or maybe tonight you've never obeyed the gospel. Maybe right now your soul is in the clutches of Satan, and it's time to give it up. It's time to obey the gospel. Jesus said in Mark 16:16, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, and he that believeth not shall be condemned." Dear friends, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? There is nothing worth losing your soul over. Obey the gospel and be restored.